You're listening to Architecture Masters.
You know, there's some very good commercial practices in this country and in London, but, you know, we're not necessarily a commercial practice. You know, sometimes I wish we were more commercial, but, you know, we don't have masses of offices. You know, we don't really design offices. We're not known as a designer of office project buildings. So we've had to kind of develop spread of culture and education and mixed use and landscape projects means that we've sort of had to look overseas. We've by virtue of the path that we've chosen, we've needed to travel.
Hello and welcome to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. With me, Owen Wainhouse.
I am John McCaslin, chairman of John McCaslin & Partners Architects.
Our guest this week is the architect John McCaslin. John was born in Glasgow and later studied architecture at Edinburgh University before following his father to the United States, where he worked for architecture firms in Baltimore, Maryland and Cambridge, Massachusetts. He returned to London in 1980 to take up a job at Richard Rogers's practice. 4 years later, he and then colleague Jamie Troughton left to start their own firm, Troughton McCaslin. Following Jamie's return to Scotland, in 1996, John went on to found John McCaslin & Partners, as the practice is known today. The practice has delivered a huge body of critically acclaimed work around the world, and was recently longlisted with Triad Architects for the ROBA's International Prize for Kericho Cathedral in Kenya. But the practice has also delivered a large body of award-winning work in London, including the Roundhouse, Friends Meeting House, and the new Western Concourse at King's Cross Station, to name just a few. John McCaslin & Partners was named World Architect of the Year in 2009 by Building Design magazine, and John was awarded the CBE for services to architecture in the 2012 Queen's New Year's Honours list. I joined John in his practice's London office just off the Euston Road, where I started, perhaps unavoidably for a podcast, by fawning over his Scottish accent.
So you can hear in your accent still a slight Scottish accent
there.
Oh yes.
And
we'll come back maybe onto Scotland, but I thought we might start maybe in Africa with a couple of projects. So Kericho, am I pronouncing
Kericho? Kericho.
Cathedral, which got me thinking. There's actually a number of projects the practice have done recently, which are kind of worship spaces, religious buildings, maybe. There's a mosque in Morden, I think you're working on. There's a
correct
a theme there. What's what's kind of led the practice into?
I don't think we haven't really planned to become experts in sacred spaces, but I think that probably the background to this, if there is any background, is that a few years ago, we were involved in projects in Haiti, looking after the earth, looking at projects that needed done after the earthquake of 2010. And there was a wonderful guy called Lord Griffiths, Leslie Griffiths, who was the superintendent minister of Wesley's College, Wesley's Church in Old Street, and. So he was head of the Methodist Church in the UK, a wonderful guy, and I've got very friendly with Leslie and his wife, and I suppose that that led to us looking at developing a project with him for the crypt at Wesley's Chapel in Old Street to develop a sort of history of Methodism, and probably, you know, that got quite a lot of coverage, and it sort of opened up knowledge of the practice to a number of people who thought we might get involved in faith-related projects. But then, really, by accident, we got commissioned for the cathedral in Kericho. I was giving a talk in Dundee at the Royal Institute of Architects in Scotland conference, and there's a chap there whose daughter actually worked in Houston for a chap who wanted to build a cathedral of all things in Africa. And so we were commissioned for that, right, because the chap came up to me in the end and said he liked the work, and he particularly liked our approach to projects in Africa, which were effectively, you know, pro bono project schools and things. And so there was a design that had that existed.
Yeah.
They weren't particularly fond of it, and so we were engaged with Arup to design. And actually, I'll be absolutely honest, I wasn't wild about the idea and you know, the beginning of the conversation about designing a cathedral in Africa, because I did think, you know, it will be perhaps a little excessive, and you know, what is, you know, why spend $5 million or $10 million or whatever is in a cathedral when perhaps educational space or health space might be more important. But actually, as we got involved in the project, number one is it was very economical, number two is we built in education spaces. And I think the other thing is we recognised that that cathedral with a congregation of about 1,500 was really the heart of that community. So we sort of embraced that idea and we built the cathedral. And as you say, we've built a couple of mosques, actually one in Doha as part of the Musharraf project, and the second, which we're now developing in Morden. So, and in fact, there's another mosque where Aidan Potter, one of the partners here, is looking at in Havering. So we've sort of wandered in, sort of accidentally, to being involved in developing spiritual environments.
And interestingly, then the.
But in fairness, actually, on, you know, there are other architects. You know, now McLaughlin has built a beautiful chapel, in, I think, in Oxford. You know, it's not unique. So lots of architects have been. You know, John Powson, I think, developed a project in France. So I think it's a sort of thing, a project that you wouldn't, you know, that you would welcome as an architect to get involved in. You know, it's not designing a prison, which most architects would avoid.
You know,
it's a kind of different, you know, you don't necessarily even have to be deeply religious to...
Well, that...
You just have to have a sense that you want to
make a special place,
make
really.
A special place,
and
absolutely.
That, I mean, for me, Friends Meeting House on not far from here on Euston Road. That
exactly.
You know, I'm not religious, but that's a special place.
Exactly.
And there's something
exactly
whether spiritual or whether.
I mean, funnily enough, there it was. You're absolutely right. I mean, that was a listed building, not a particularly good building, I don't think, and the main meeting hall was this flat-ceilinged, big, dark, grim, sort of gloomy environment. And when you look at the Friends' sort of ambition or mission of the Friends to have light and space to contemplate, you know, to consider the world, that sort of led us to looking at, in very simple terms, how could we respond to creating a space which had that sort of, I don't know, uniformity and simplicity of form that, if possible, could be top lit so as people could gaze upward and look through towards the sky and things. And we basically just created this amazing void through the space, which connected with, we created a roof light at high level, similar to what we did at the Royal Society of Arts a few years back in off the Strand. And this sort of pyramidal form, I guess, in the middle of the space. We talked for a while with James Turrell, the great American artist, who's also a Quaker. And one of the ideas that we'd hoped to build out, but which unfortunately we couldn't, and which James had developed an idea for, was this great roof that would slide, the glass roof would slide. And when it rained or when it snowed, rain would sort of pour through the roof light onto the floor and be drained. I mean, or snow, I mean, imagine what it would have been like last week. It would have been the most spectacular space. Wasn't possible, but we sort of carried forward some of, you know, his ideas into the develop project. So you're right. I think the Quaker's House was the large meeting house, and you know, also was a example of our work in that field.
And that maybe then brings us on just further down the Euston Road to King's Cross, and that maybe a similar kind of special space there with a. The Western Concourse, that vast roof, and a period of for people stopping and waiting, and time to reflect and to before moving on. That again is a special space.
Well, I think it's kind of, you'd say that. I mean, I think that King's Cross is a long process of development. it also had a long process of gestation for developing ideas. And I think that on one hand, we felt that train travelers were giving us a bum deal. You know, if you spent, you know, when you look at Terminal 5, or you look at the Madrid airport by Rogers and other great, you know, new airport structures, you know, there's been a sort of celebration of travel through those. And a lot of the sort of new railway stations, in this country at least, were sort of gloomy and dark, and certainly the existing station was gloomy and dark at King's Cross. So we felt we wanted to instill in it some of the drama and excitement and a sense that, you know, travel is for everyone, that people could enjoy the sort of space that perhaps they weren't used to. But the initial inspiration, whilst it was both the great kind of Victorian sheds of railway stations, was also, funny enough, the TWA terminal in New York, which is the Ira Saarinen terminal, which was, you know, was one of those great kind of fabulous modernist structures. And so actually, that rather than Victorian station structures, that was the, and sort of Luigi Nervi structure. So that was probably the inspiration. And then we combined that with, in a way, some of the limitations we had of how the structure would needed to be supported, because it couldn't just land on the concourse. It needed to be supported on its perimeter because there was a concourse beneath that was being built. And we had brilliant engineers in the case of Arup. So it was effectively a combination of Arup, our sort of ambitions, and Arup's, you know, engineering virtuosity, which led to the development of the concourse. And I think it's, you know, it's pretty sort of amazing structure to be in.
Yeah.
But unusual, I suppose,
for a kind of
contemporary railway station in this country. Not so much overseas, but I mean, in this country, you know, we haven't really managed to, I think, to develop stations of the quality and character of historic Victorian or Edwardian ones.
And that's coming back a bit now, maybe. So I thought then we might talk about some recent projects. I'm kind of interested to jump back. You were born in Glasgow. And I think you've said in other places you started, you know, I'm just wondering really where the kind of architectural interest came in. You've talked in a few places about geography and about an early kind of interest there. Were any parents, is there any architects in the family?
No, as you said, our family was all from Glasgow. On my mother's side, they were lawyers of, you know, impoverished middle class lawyers. And on my father's side, they were sort of involved in my great-grandfather, I think, on my father's side, was the town clerk of Glasgow, so he was involved in politics and things. And on my mother's side, her grandfather was both a lawyer and wrote the history of Glasgow. So they were very much embedded in the culture of Glasgow in various ways. Yeah. But no architects, although my father was a sort of monkey architect. He considered himself to have a good eye as an architect. I'm not sure that was the case, bless him. And all I remember is he designed our house when I was a kid growing up in Dunoon in the west coast of Scotland, which had all sorts of problems attached to it, one of which the builders put the windows in the wrong way around, back to front, if you can believe it. So you sort of went outside to open them. I think that was corrected. So he created these very odd spaces, very odd spaces that I think he thought were going to be great bits of architecture, but weren't. And I maybe that sort of spaces, which actually were quite ingenious, but weren't very practical. And so I think he thought of himself as a bit of an architect. But there was no history of that in the family. But I do remember as a kid going to Glasgow often and being introduced to, you know, the work of Mackintosh and people like that. So it was always an important part of my upbringing was Glasgow as a city and its architecture. Yeah. And, you know, and I think probably that instilled in me something of the interest, but it wasn't really until, and as you say, I mean, I was probably more interested in geography. I was really interested, I still am very interested in geography and I sort of was probably going to move into that field of being a cartographer or something like that. Okay. I was very interested in mapping and things. I've always been interested in mapping. So, and I think that then evolved into sort of architecture. But the school I went to did say that I couldn't be an architect because I hadn't studied physics or chemistry or anything like that, so they gave me really bad advice. But I managed to get into university nevertheless to do architecture.
And so it was for an undergrad degree straight into architecture?
Into architecture school. But, you know, again, until I went, my father had emigrated to America when we were young, and although my mother stayed in Scotland. And I remember really, I think the moment when I discovered architecture was when, not so much my first 3 years at university in Edinburgh, which is where I went to university, not Glasgow, was when going to America to both work in an architect's office in Baltimore, which was a city a bit like Glasgow, actually, in a funny kind of way. Mm. But also, but then I travelled a great deal on a Greyhound and bus and travelled across America. So I saw, you know, the great work on the West Coast and Chicago and Buffalo and places like that, particularly the, you know, that strip west from, so, you know, works of John Lautner or Frank Lloyd Wright or, you know, the Louis Sullivan, people like that. So Louis Kahn in Philadelphia. So I remember when I came back after my year out, I really had suddenly kind of, you know, that was a great moment of discovering great architecture.
If you weren't sure before the undergrad, you were absolutely sure.
But when I, exactly, so I came back, you know, Le Corbusier's Carpenter Center in Boston or Cambridge, which is his only project in America. H.H. Richardson, who was a great architect, you know, from the East Coast of America. So I saw all these people, who some of whom were very unfashionable, you know, because they were, you know, that, in a way, and then I worked in Cambridge, Massachusetts, with a firm called Cambridge Seven, which was very much a modernist firm, founded by, Serge Chemaev's sons, Ivan and Peter. And so that had that kind of Harvard, MIT, academic, modernist background, European modernism. So that was the next, you know, part of the journey was to discover that that world. And then effectively I emigrated to America, got a green card, thought I was going to live and work there, and but then eventually returned to Britain to work at Rogers' office, Richard Rogers.
And it was the move then back to the UK.
Back to the UK, but you know, when I'd never really been to London. I mean, I'd never spent time in London, and so coming back in 1981, as it was you know. Was amazing. I mean, it was as exciting as going to New York or something. In a funny kind of way, I found Boston a bit provincial as a city, I'll be absolutely honest. I thought it was kind of small. Much as I loved it, I thought, well, I had to come back because you had to get qualified as an architect, and you couldn't get qualified in America as a British-trained architect. You'd have worked there about 10 years to get registered.
So you had to come back to do part two, part three.
I can't remember which one. I think it must be in part two. And I was fortunate enough to meet a good friend of ours called Judy Bing, who I met at Cambridge Seven and who knew Richard from the Pompidou Centre days. He was coming to Cambridge Seven to see Judy with John Young, Richard's partner at that time. And I said to Judy, listen, I'm kind of keen to, I have to go back. Could you introduce me to Richard and John? And she did, and got on very well. So, and they were great, you know, they were kind of hip and youthful and exciting guys. So I decided to come back and worked with in their office for 3-4 years until I then set up.
Very early 80s then.
Very, until 84, I think, 83, 84, when I met Jamie Trotton, who worked there. But it was a brilliant, brilliant time. I mean, to be in London was phenomenally exciting. And, you know, it was a time where, when you think of the difficulties now as a young person in London, you know, whole issue of affordability. I remember I walked into a flat that was, you know, in Maida Vale, that was a garden flat that I rented with you know, a basement flat with somebody else. And, you know, you could rent flats affordably in the, you know, Maida Vale, for God's sake. You know, and so it was much, much more. The other thing was everybody at Richards of my generation was buying property, was buying a flat, which of course I had no idea. I mean, you know, who bought a flat? And the rule of thumb was you bought it 3 times your salary. So the salary then was, I don't know, £6,500 or something. So we bought, everybody seemed to buy a flat at about 18,000. I did that. And you know, think of that now. Salaries have probably risen 4 times, but properties have risen about 20 or 30 times. So the lack of affordability now is crippling for young people in London. But then it seemed to be so much easier. I mean, it really was. When I tell my kids about how I was able to rent Midavail and buy a flat in Kilburn and da da da, and everybody was doing this, it was on what, you know, it's obviously incredibly hard now.
Yeah.
Affordability, living in London.
And you must see that now with running a, I mean, how big's the office now? What
we've got about 55 people. Okay. We're actually smaller now than we've been for probably the last 5 years. But we're building back up. Last summer there was a couple of projects we were doing stopped, which was a bit of a blow. So very unfortunately, a number of people had to leave. And but almost towards the end of the year, we began to build up again. So we're actually now hiring on a number of new projects.
Right.
So okay. We're sort of regrouped and we're building back up.
So an office in London, where we are now, and then another office in Doha and Edinburgh.
We've got a small space in Doha. We've got a proper office in Edinburgh. And we've just actually become registered in New York. We're thinking of opening a studio there because there's a lot of exciting projects. Yeah. So we've got, we haven't yet licensed, but we've now registered as a practice in the last couple of weeks. So we're keen to have sort of satellite project offices based around projects.
Right.
Like Edinburgh. Edinburgh is effectively doing 2 projects. One is the Borough Museum in Glasgow, which is the key project. So we, building up through projects, if you know what I mean.
But for the kind of scale of work and scale of the project, it's quite a lean operation, really, quite... I'm always interested, really, in how people perceive practices from outside before you come in and thinking about the size and the scale. Relatively small office compared to the kind of impact you're having.
I think the reality is that we do a lot of projects in collaboration with others. So, for instance, Aidan Potter, partner here, does his portfolio of work, if we can call it, is mostly in Russia.
Okay.
Well, we have executive architects in Russia. Right. So he designs the projects and there's an executive architect.
Right.
And in Doha, we were the design architects. There was an executive architect. Okay. We I think it's probably by the time this goes out, we will have been awarded a major project in Sydney, which is a transport project, which we hear about, or rather we have heard we've won as part of a consortium. And, you know, we're partnering Sydney-based architect. Yeah. So, you know, half of the work or something will be ours. So we do a huge amount of work collaboratively, and therefore, take all the international work, and about half of our projects are international. So, you know, we do the work for a much bigger practice, but in partnership, often collaboration with others. So about a year ago, I moved my desk downstairs, so I work on the shop floor with everybody else. We've got really 1.5 floors here, and it's brilliant because you hear everything. There's a much greater dynamic. So I don't have an office; I just have a desk.
Yeah.
And so I've enjoyed. I mean, I really have enjoyed the scaling back to a much tighter group. It really is. It means you know everybody, you know the work. So we will inevitably grow back up, but I'm quite keen to, and you can do an awful lot of work with 50 people. You can do 5 or 10 big projects.
Yeah.
You know, you don't need vast numbers of people.
Has that been a kind of a calculated setup then in terms of the international work and in terms of the kind of collaborative style, or has that just evolved sort of naturally? What was that?
Well, I think probably. I mean,
you clearly like the international work.
Like the international work, and I think we have an international outlook on the world, and we like being out there doing things. And we've got, so I think we travel quite well to places that are sort of perhaps not thought of as I mean, like Moscow or St. Petersburg, those are probably thought to be difficult environments. Doha is probably thought to be a very difficult environment to work in, but we've found it relatively straightforward because we've adapted and we like the cultural challenges, and we're doing development projects now in India. We hoped in the States, in Sydney. So I think we've been able to, in Italy, where we built the Max Mara headquarters, so we've been in Moscow, in Turkey, in Istanbul. So I think we've been able to, I mean, I certainly enjoy it, and I think the people here we work with are really interested in working internationally. And the other thing, Owen, I think, is that we're not some very good commercial practices in this country and in London, but, you know, we're not necessarily a commercial practice. Right. You know, sometimes I wish we were more commercial, but, you know, we don't have masses of offices.
Yeah.
You know, we don't really design offices. We're not known as a designer of office project buildings. You know, residential, and particularly affordable residential, yes, but not. So we've had to kind of develop, you know, our portfolio is mostly infrastructure, so transportation, public realm projects, culture, education, some residential mixed use, adaptive reuse. You know, it's not. And that's fine. I think that you know that we're, and also that kind of, you know, spread of culture and education and mixed use and landscape projects means that we are, you know, we've sort of had to look overseas.
Yeah, there's a limited amount of projects in this country.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we've. You know, by virtue of the path that we've chosen, we've needed to travel.
Yeah.
But we like it. You know, I kind of enjoy it.
It's fun. Yeah. It's fun. So we spoke, I mean, kind of interesting then, just to explore the kind of process of starting the office. We spoke to Hugh Broughton a few episodes back about his work in the Antarctic.
Yeah.
And I think he worked for you at Troughton McCaslin.
Exactly.
And so... you both left then. I forget his first name, Troughton.
Jamie.
Jamie Troughton.
Jamie, yeah.
So you both worked at Richard Rogers.
Jamie was a contemporary of Graham Morrison at Cambridge University.
Right.
And I was a contemporary Bob was, I think, a year older than I was, or a year, you know, further ahead at Edinburgh. And broadly, we set up at this sort of same sort of time, I guess. And I met Jamie at Richard's office, where he was involved in the Lloyds project. And it was clear that Jamie was never going to be his career was never going to be at Richard's office. He was inevitably going to be doing his own thing.
Right.
And I suppose that eventually, much as I loved working at Richard's office, I thought, well, I want to be doing my own thing.
Yeah.
And it happened that literally Jamie said, well, why don't you join me? And he left. And then about 6 months later, I joined him.
Right. Okay.
And it was kind of funny when we set up, because I remember that Jamie had left and I was still at Richard's.
Yeah.
And Richard had a partner called Marco Goldschmidt.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a tough guy, a former president of the RIB.
Yeah.
Perfectly decent guy, but you're quite a sort of tough guy, uncompromising. And I remember I went away at Christmas and came back in New Year, and there was somebody sitting on my desk.
Right.
And it was Graham Sturck, still there.
Yeah.
Graham was sitting in my, and all my belongings were in a cardboard box. And so I said to him, I went and see Marco, and he said, what the hell's this? You know, where's my desk? And I had been asked to stay on part-time.
Yeah.
Also, there wasn't enough work in the practice to finish a project I'd been doing, Pat Centre in Cambridge, second phase of PA Technology Centre in Cambridge. And I said, well, Marco, you know...
What's this?
What the hell's this? He said, well, you know, you decided to leave, and you know, we're short of space, and Graham's joined us to do so. And I said, well, Marco, just remember, I didn't want to stay, I wanted to leave.
Yeah.
I, you know, you asked me to
stay on.
To stay on, and I honored it.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, fuck this, I'm off.
Yeah.
So I went downstairs, and I remember there was no mobile phones, and I called, there's a phone in reception, I phoned Jamie, yeah. I said, I think I fired myself, because I told Marco to fuck off.
Yeah.
And he said, go back upstairs, apologise to Marco,
yeah.
we don't have enough work, you know, grovel back. So I had to go and grovel. And but it's kind of funny, I mean, Graham's there.
Yeah, he's still know, there.
Still
yeah,
there
yeah,
as a partner.
Yeah.
And so that was the end of me. I did stay on a couple of months, and then I left.
And what sort of size was the practice then when you left? I mean, there were a lot bigger Richards, yeah.
Well, you see, it was probably about 30 people.
Okay.
I mean, it wasn't big. Yeah, and they shared it with PA Technology, which was a... and the idea was to venture... The reason for collaboration was that not only had Richard designed the PA building in Cambridge, and actually then I worked on one in Princeton.
Yeah.
But that the... idea was that they would develop, with particularly Mike Davies, the partner, facades and industrial technology stuff, really interesting. They did some work, not a huge amount, but they did, so for instance, on the InMOS factory and things, they collaborated. Yeah. But they had probably about 25 people and Richard had about 35. So, and they occupied a space, which eventually our practice took, Prince's Place. It was a beautiful courtyard, and it was so we eventually let the space, and I ended up sitting in the same seat I had sat at. Not the one, not exactly the same one, because the one that
Graham was still there.
But it was very odd. We went back to this, and we took the whole building, and it was a great space, and we would probably be back there. The only reason we left was it had become very inaccessible. You know, back in the 80s, nobody really seemed to mind getting the tube to Holland Park and walking down the street.
Yeah.
Or people took taxis and all that stuff.
Here
is much, much more... But it became sort of slightly inaccessible. Yeah. It became regarded as inaccessible, so I moved here. And in all honesty, I think we'd be probably happier back in Prince's Place because it was a wonderful environment to be in. But it was just a bit hard to get to for people.
Okay. So you and Jamie then running Troughton MacCaslin, and then what sort of 4 years later set up.
Well, Jamie's life was going to change. He was going to move up to Scotland, and so that was about 1996. So it's actually quite a long year. It was over 10 years, and in 1996, he was going to move up to Scotland, and I decided that I didn't, in fairness, I couldn't, you know, I wanted to effectively have my own practice, and he was very relaxed about it because his life was changing. And in fact, he collaborates now quite often with Hugh Broughton. So it's Broughton and Troughton, or Troughton and Broughton. And so I went off on my own, and with the same group, I think there was about 8 people at that point.
Okay.
Nick Eldridge and Pierce Smerin, who were very good, who then set up their own, and a few other people. So basically, I took the practice on, and which was kind of quite scary because Jamie had provided, I mean, he was a very good designer, Jamie, but also he was a brilliant sort of, strategically, he was very strong, he was very strong financially.
Right.
So he kind of led the practice in that way. And I realized I didn't really have those skills. But I needed to, I mean, I wanted to practice on my own, in all honesty. So that was 1996. That was about 22 years ago.
Okay.
And we built up, you know, from within a couple of years, we'd won the King's Cross project. So that was 1998.
Yeah.
So we did a couple of projects in Turkey that actually Jamie had begun, and then I finished the headquarters and for a bank, and a few other things. So we were we became quite busy quite quickly. Either from projects that we were already doing jointly or projects that we won independently.
It's quite a scary thing, really. I'm just kind of thinking about practices where there's a number of partners and I suppose people there to talk issues through with and talk, but it takes something kind of a boldness maybe to.
Well, you don't necessarily have. I mean, I've got 3 partners now who have been with me for years. There's Aidan Potter, who's brilliant and was, you know, our first employee at Trotman.
Right. Okay.
Aidan then left, He joined Terry Farrell.
Okay.
He set up something called the Escape Committee, which was basically like a prisoner of war kind of escape. So he headed the Escape Committee. But then he came back, which was great. So he went away for about 7 years and then came back, and he's absolutely brilliant. And Natasha Martin, who's our finance director, who's been with me for years. And Hannah Lawson, who joined as a student from the Bartlett. He became Young Women Architect of the Year.
Yeah.
And, you know, so we've worked together collaboratively for a long, long period. And then we've got a whole bunch of, you know, people who have been with Thanos Panaides, who's probably been with us 15 years, again, from being a student, runs a transport team, and Andy Harris, landscape, a guy called James Dixon, and a whole raft of younger architects who are coming through. So it is, I mean, I enjoy it because it's because I like, you know, I prefer being my own boss, if you know what I mean. Yeah. I'm not great in partnership. I mean, I am fine, I think, in the role I play. I enjoyed working with Jamie, but I really didn't enjoy the joint decision-making part.
That joint decision-making in terms of design or in terms of kind of strategy?
I don't know what it was. I think I just felt that I wanted to do things my own way, and if that meant I failed, but I wanted to... I didn't necessarily always want to defer to someone else.
Right.
And, you know, I was happily married and remain happily married, but I thought, well, that's my partnership. I don't want a business partnership. But, you know, Hannah and Aidan and Natasha are brilliant partners to have, and they are effectively design part studio partners. So Hannah develops cultural projects, educational projects. Aidan does all the Russian portfolio. Natasha is a phenomenal, you know, business leader and financial lady and financial person. And I sort of I try to hold it together and do projects. And that seems to work. It's worked better now than I think it's ever worked, because I think we are each have our own skills and space, but we come together and we collaborate where it's appropriate and we get on well, but we're not in each other's hair. But there's... So I think, it's... I mean, I think it works for them. Yeah. It certainly works for me. But the journey now is to build the succession of the next generation to run the practice. Because I really don't do, and I don't really run very much. I don't take part in any of the operational stuff, which is really good.
Yeah.
So I used to meddle, but I don't think I meddle now because I leave other people, and other people just say, look, we're doing it. Don't meddle.
Right. And so how much of your time now is on kind of, how much is design, how much is kind of future thinking or meeting clients or
I think probably about a third of my time is on projects.
Okay.
So after this, we've got a meeting with a client, and I'm participating in that. And about tomorrow, I'm going up to Glasgow for a project that I'm doing. After a project my wife and I are doing in a town I grew up in Dunoon, which is a project that we an old hall that we built and turned into a cultural centre. So we're just. We have a board meeting up there, which that's something.
And you say your wife, is she an architect?
Oh, no, she's not. She's just sympathetic to architecture.
Right.
And
sympathetic to? I'm going to use that term.
Sympathetic,
I think.
To architecture. No, she actually. What frustrates me is that she's now got a much better eye than I have for almost anything that's creative.
Right.
She seems to have a much. I say, hold on a minute. I'm meant to be the creative one. You now make all the right decisions. But the and then we have a meeting on Burrell.
Yeah.
And then. On Friday, I go to the BVI, British Virgin Islands, which is to look at spend 3 days, 4 days with an engineer called Adrian Campbell, excellent guy from formerly of Arup, on the reconstruction of the BVI post Hurricane Irma.
Yeah.
So that's like a task force, I suppose it's like a government thing that DFID or DIT have set up. So we are now doing that.
That's kind of an increasing. But I mean, there's the foundation that you run, and
it's a trust that we set up about 20 years ago, and that was for education and cultural and community projects, and we have a student bursary with the RIBA, which we need to reinvigorate.
That sort of slightly brings us back to sort of where we started a little bit in terms of that quite a social minded. I mean, you talked about not being a heavily commercial practice, but a lot of the projects you're working on are very socially minded, would you say?
In part. I mean, we've got the other thing just with the bursary on for a moment. I mean, there's what I really liked about it is we've had some fantastic people come through who have won the bursary or participated and have built their career. You know, people like Asif Khan, who's a brilliant artist.
Really, right.
I keep telling Asif, I made your career. I don't know if he thinks I'm joking, but I am joking. Julia King, who was, again, Young Women Architect of the Year. A lady called Umi Baden-Powell, who's brilliant, who's now working back here, working here a couple of days a week, and she's doing a lot of research work. So and is working on the BVI project. So I like that type of engagement with young architects who have, and you know, the Asif and Julia and Umi and others all have a view of the world which is, you know, I mean, they're very open and committed designers and committed, you know, socially committed. And I warm to that approach. So I think you're probably right. I think quite a lot of our work relates to that. I mean, that's why when I go back to commercial offices, you know, I can't, you know, the idea of designing a shell and core commercial office leaves me cold. I think, why?
Yeah.
This empty space that's got no life of itself. So I think that's why projects for end users or cultural projects or civic projects or, you know, school projects are the things that, you know, that have an obvious end user are the ones that we're best at.
Right.
Where you kind of engage with this constituency who are going to occupy the building, not just a commercial developer.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that doesn't really interest us hugely. I mean, sometimes we do it well and sometimes, you know, we're less successful.
Yeah. That's fascinating. Just then, as we start to round up, just kind of interested in, you've obviously chosen to stay in London as home, still obviously very connected to work in Scotland and a lot around the world, but chosen to keep London as your base. What do you find, I mean, just interested about things you find maybe inspirational or interesting or maybe even problematic around London? You know, just a few words about London as a home.
I mean, I do love London. Our kids are, you know, were born and educated and see themselves as Londoners. My wife's from the States, you know, I'm from Scotland. So we're all, I find it endlessly fascinating as a city and complicated and complex and enriching and multicultural, which is important, and lots of problems, obviously social problems, economic problems, affordable housing issues. In fact, one of the other projects, we're now doing something called Hidden Homelessness, which is a project that looks at the young problems of young homelessness, and that's a competition that Colander have established now. So it's looking for our designers to come forward with ideas to address the issue of young homelessness. Yeah. So I think London is absolutely our home, and I love the multicultural nature of the place. And I don't think I would ever tire of being in London because it's got great, it's history. I feel that connected to its history.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I never tire of London.
No. Okay.
Never.
Fantastic.
Very good.
That's a lovely place to finish off. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
You've been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. On the programme this week was John McCaslin. You can find out more about John and his work at architecturemasters.org, from where you can also subscribe to the podcast and follow us on Twitter. If you've enjoyed this episode, why not leave a review or a rating in your podcast provider, as this helps others to discover the programme. I'm Owen Wainhouse. Thank you for listening.